Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with CNN's John King. Could the president find more common ground on immigration reform with the GOP than his own party? Then we'll talk about books. Remember them? Would you prefer reading to have a soundtrack and special effects? Well, they're available. Then leading Republican candidate for governor, Charlie Baker, joins us in the studio. Years ago, Charlie was in charge of what is now the embattled Department of Children and Families. We'll talk about that and much more.
Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School joins us on retirement. At the rate we're going, lots of us will never be able to afford it, but lots of us don't want it either. Then the Woody Allen dilemma. Have the latest child abuse allegations against this cinematic genius ruined your enjoyment of his Oscar-nominated Blue Jasmine or Annie Hall or Manhattan, Crimes and Misdemeanors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7. Rowdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
I have good news because I just heard that guy say, it was Jordan Weinstein say, what is it, 8 to 10 inches? Only 44 more days till spring. Keep that in mind.
What the little whoosie was he say, that the groundhog say? Did you keep abreast of that?
I didn't want you to know. Let's move on. You know, President Obama says he wants comprehensive immigration reform done this year, but to get it, will he have to ally himself with the GOP or with his fellow Dems? Then there's the Keystone Pipeline. It's creating a political headache for the president, with the State Department downplaying the pipeline's effect on global warming. Environmentalists are ramping up their opposition to the project, and Republicans and much of organized labor are decidedly more gung-ho about it. Joining us to talk about these and other political headlines is John King. He is CNN's chief national correspondent and host of CNN's terrific new Sunday morning show, which both of us watched this week, Inside Politics. Congratulations and welcome, John.
Oh, thanks. It was a fun first week. It's good to be with you. And because of all those issues you just talked about, I think just as you guys have fun on the radio, I'm going to have a little fun on TV. It's a great election year, fun things to talk about, including immigration and Keystone. Boy, we're going to learn a lot about our president, aren't we? Is he going to side with the left? Is he going to try to split the difference? Is he going to think more about legacy than his party in 2014? That's what makes this year so interesting.
Well, you know, since you brought it up, I was going to ask you first about your new show. But since you brought it up, he is in somewhat of a dilemma on the Keystone Pipeline, because the State Department report basically said that the environmental havoc that was going to be wreaked by this pipeline, not so much, that the oil is going to be transported one way or the other, and that the pipeline is not necessarily the disaster that many people, environmentalists, hope that they would say. So what does he do?
It's a really tough call for the president, because you heard him in his State of the Union address. And again, think about a president now in year six who knows after the midterm elections it's going to be really hard to get things done. His own party is starting to run from him, let alone the Republicans. So do you think legacy? I mean, look how proud he sounded when he said, you know, this isn't the Jimmy Carter day. So the United States is producing more of its own energy than ever before. Does he want to add to that legacy and add that word that begins with a J and ends with an S, jobs? I mean, that's been the biggest problem for this president. People don't feel the recovery. And so he's not getting any credit, even though Wall Street's had a tough couple of days maybe, but Wall Street had a pretty good, very good 2013. People's 401ks looking good, right? The unemployment rate's down, right? And yet the president's stuck in the middle here because he's getting no credit for the economy. Does he think, you know what, let the environmentalists be mad at me? I want the jobs. I want the labor guys happy in a midterm election year. So let's do that. A tough one here, and he's delayed this and punted it down the road. I'm not saying for bad reasons or cynical reasons. They wanted to study this, they wanted to study that. But at some point, you got to make a decision, and the president's looking at a tough one pretty soon. There are a lot of people who think he, in his heart, wants to go forward with this and is trying to answer some of the environmental concerns if he can.
We're talking with John King from CNN. You know, John, even before this new State Department report came out, back in September, a Pew poll showed that 65% of Americans in general support the pipeline, and 51% of Democrats do too. So it's not like he doesn't have some support. And I would imagine after this State Department report, he'll have more support.
I don't think it's a question of political support writ large, if you will, out in the country. The question is certain interest groups in the Democratic Party who can be loud, who can have an impact on primaries. He's not going to face another one, obviously. He's not running again. But who can cause some trouble for the administration and who can get, some people back in the president's face. Look, if he has something that tells him environmentally this is a disaster and he can't do it and he wants to stand up against public opinion, I'm all for politicians who, for reasons of principle, whether we think they're right or wrong, are willing to stand up against public opinion. So if he wants to do that because of something he sees or he believes, again, not taking sides in the Keystone Pipeline, more power to him as a politician. Too many politicians just look at the polls, look at their campaign consultants, and say, check, check, do. And sometimes it's check, check, flip-flop. So if he wants to stand, you know, good for him. But he's going to have to explain it, because if you look at where the pipeline goes, if you look at where the jobs would be, a lot of Republican states, but a lot of prairie states where, you know, where Democrats and labor unions want those jobs, and a lot of places where politicians on the ballot this year, Democrats and Republicans, would like to be at some ribbon cuttings. They'd like to be at some ceremonies saying, hey, we're going to bring some jobs here.
Can I be conspiratorial for a minute, like the vast majority
Absolutely.
Of my fellow Americans?
He is. It's like a Machiavelli here, John.
I have to admit, I haven't read the State Department report, but I've read a lot of news accounts of it. The conspiratorial view is when you're the president of the United States and your own State Department is writing about something that matters as much to you as it does, and your party as it does, and organized labor as it does, you cook the books, meaning you tell them what you want the outcome to be, and then they figure out how to get to the outcome. So the cynical side of me says, even if that's a bit of an exaggeration, this is what he wanted it to be, or it wouldn't have been.
That's a possibility, although, you know, it wouldn't be the first issue on which he and, say, the new Secretary of State, relatively new, it's been a year now, he and John Kerry disagree on some things, so maybe Secretary Kerry wants it and the president doesn't. Look, there are other agencies of the government that have different opinions, and I criticize the bureaucracy all the time, so let me say this. If you have departments who have people looking at this who are coming to their own independent judgments, and the State Department's not afraid to be at odds with the Interior Department or at odds with the EPA or at odds with, I'm making it up, somebody else, good for them. Again, we want people to sort of arrive at independent-minded decisions, not politically driven decisions. Whatever the source of the State Department report, though, it puts the president in a tough spot because, remember, he authorized part of the pipeline. Now the question is, do you authorize the second half of it, which is, you know, the quote-unquote hard part and the difficult part politically when it comes to the environmental movement? And again, you have a president wrestling with his legacy, a president looking at the legitimate question of energy production. You know, let's assume we all want to get rid of fossil fuels and our dependence on them in the next, we'd like to do it by yesterday. It's going to take another 25 years or more. The technology doesn't exist just yet, or the mass marketing of it doesn't exist just yet. So if you're this president and you're looking at the next 25 years or so, and you're looking at jobs over the next 2 or 3 years or so, the pressures are to say yes. We'll see what he does in the end, though.
John, we used to ask you every single week for an immigration update, and then we stopped because it was pretty clear there was nothing to update. Well, now the Republicans, while they're not into this pathway to citizenship, they're on a pathway to legal status. And while a lot of Democrats are not happy, it seems that the president himself, who apparently, I think I read you saying this, you didn't use these words, had drawn a line in the sand around that pathway to citizenship, that the president actually may be willing to accept that. Is that a fair statement of where things are?
I think it is a fair statement of where things are. If you go back 1 year ago exactly, he gave a speech in Nevada to a Latino organization in which he said you have to have a path to citizenship. It just doesn't work. Otherwise, you create a second-tier, second-class a group of Americans. If you say you can have status but not citizenship, you can stay here, you know, forever, but you don't get citizenship. That's what he said a year ago. And from the White House podium, Jay Carney has said this repeatedly. The president has said it in other settings. But he had an interview last week with CNN's Jake Tapper, and he was asked about the Republican plan, which is status, not no fast track to citizenship. You get legal status, and then you can get in line, just like somebody who's sitting in Guatemala today or Mexico today or Lithuania today, for that matter. You can get in line with them and go through the process and maybe get citizenship, but you don't get a fast track. The Senate bill essentially takes, if you're already in the United States, you get to almost pretty much cut to the head of the line in most cases, or get ahead of most people. It's a fast track process. And the president said, I'm not going to prejudge that. I want to see what they can do. Again, you're in year six on an issue that you promised to deal with in year one, and you see the possibility you can get 80%. A lot of people would say pretty reasonable, pretty practical and pretty pragmatic. Nancy Pelosi doesn't like that. Organized labor doesn't like that. The key person to watch would be Harry Reid, and I say would be because I'm still skeptical the House can get this done. But let's see if John Boehner can get his House Republican in a year where many conservatives are telling him, I don't have Latino voters back home, Mr. Speaker. Can we not do this year? Mm. If you look at the House Republicans, most of them are from predominantly white districts. Most of them have much lower than the national average Latino vote and African-American vote. A lot of the conservatives are saying we need base turnout, conservative-based turnout. They don't want us to touch the citizenship or the status issue, please, Mr. Speaker. But he wants to get it done. If the House passes that, then the Senate has to compromise with the House to get anything to the president's desk. So this isn't an issue for the president for a long time. Harry Reid is from Nevada. His labor unions, Latino-driven, want citizenship. Does he accept a compromise and send something to the president this year, or does he want the issue? A very influential voice, a guy who has criticized the president pretty much from day one in the White House, Luis Gutierrez, a congressman, a Democrat from the president's own city of Chicago, he says, you know what, it's time to compromise, then we'll come back and fight for the rest. But is he, you know, are there enough of those people out there? It would be really a fascinating choice for this president to see, again, the old Ronald Reagan school. Do you take 80% and say that's a good deal, or do you hold fast for an issue that has really helped the Democrats? But we're weeks, if not months, away from that, because the House would have to pass it first, and then Harry Reid would have to decide if he wants to do business.
John King, you wrote a great piece about this on your website, but to me, it seems to me a no-brainer. I'm not the political analyst you are or Jim is, but if you do get 80%, you're not having people deported. You're not having these horrible, wrenching stories of people getting pulled over and mothers sent back to their country of origin, leaving their children here and stuff like that. You don't get the citizenship, but you do get – and also, they're not going to get citizenship – I don't think with this dysfunctional situation in Washington. So I don't get why anybody would not take three quarters of the loaf as opposed to no loaf at all.
Look, there's a persuasive argument from the Latino groups and the immigrant groups about, you know, yes, these people crossed the border illegally. Yes, they, you know, so they committed a crime, if you will. But in the case, you know, they've been here 15 or 20 or 30 years or, you know, 10 years. So they've committed no crimes. They're working. They're paying Social Security. Why can't we cut them a break? You know, it's a persuasive argument when you listen to it. I'm not accepting it, but if you listen to it. But to your point, look, if you get legal status and you have a right then to apply for citizenship, you're not being denied citizenship, number one. You're not being told you can never get it. You're just being told we're not going to put you at the front of the line.
Which erases a problem that a lot of people have. They don't like the idea of the people who broke the law jumping ahead of those who are home waiting legally to come here.
Right. And some people say they broke the law, they should never get citizenship, and they should never get status because they broke the law. And that's a persuasive argument, too. When you hear somebody make it, they say, wait a minute, what message are we sending to our children or to the next generation of immigrants when we say if you break the law, you know, you broke the law, and yet you get to be a citizen. So that's an argument, too. The question is, there are, you know, close to 12 million people here in the United States. So one argument's persuasive. The other argument's persuasive. The reality is there are 11.8 or 12 million, pick your number. They're here. And how much would it cost to go find them all, put them on buses, and throw them out? And how long would it take most of them to come back across the border? So, you know, that's the Michael Bloomberg argument, is it's too late to have this debate. They're already here. And if you ask the Chamber of Commerce or any farm interest or any manufacturing interest, they say we need those workers. So to your point, Marjorie, the economic stability and the cultural stability, the state of mind stability of we're not going to deport you. You can come out of the shadows. You can open. Maybe you want to open a small business and not work in manufacturing
exactly.
anymore. Maybe you want to take a second job.
Yeah.
You can lift your head up and not be looking over your shoulder every 5 minutes. A lot of economists on both sides. You know, I'll call them Democrats and Republicans or liberals and conservatives, say that that would just open a gateway in the economy to have that stability and less fear. And then you can have another campaign or two and have the citizenship argument. So logic tells you take the deal. Politics tells you, you know, the Democrats have benefited from the Republican crisis with Latino voters. Look at John McCain and look at Mitt Romney. So cynically, you can say, why would we want to give up that issue? This is one where, you know, I hope that people would just do the math and do the decent thing, and sit in a room and figure it out. I'm not pretending to be the smart guy here, but there actually is, after years of laughing about this, the prospects of getting something done, it's actually there. You can see the pieces. The question is, are they courageous enough and pragmatic enough to get it done?
Far, far too much thoughtful analysis for this program,
well,
John King. Is there going to be an immigration bill signed, in your estimation, John? Prior to the midterm elections, balancing all those totally legitimate factors you just described, you think there's going to be a bill, a law?
The history of this issue tells me no, because John Boehner has to thread a needle, and then Harry Reid has to swallow some pride, and he has to thread a needle. And then the president would have to accept the compromise, which I think would be the least difficult step. If you had the House and then the Senate do something, the president essentially has, you know, the elected representation of the country saying it's the right thing to do. And he can bring the interest groups around and say, we'll fight, you know, Hillary Clinton can fight for citizenship in the next presidential campaign. It's just, it's been so hard, Jim, that I don't see the magic wand. However, the speaker is, has a steel spine on this one at the moment. And then you'd have to go back over to the Senate side. Again, if you look at the Senate seats that the Republicans are targeting, there's 11 seats now held by Democrats that Republicans are targeting. They need plus six to take the majority. The highest Latino population in any of those states is North Carolina at 9%.
Well, that's really interesting.
Most of them are in the ones and twos and threes. So even Senate Republican campaign strategists say, we don't need this for 2014. I understand your problem for 2016, all of you who want to be president. But a lot of them think we don't need it in 2014, but we do need conservative turnout. So that's the political worry. And it's a legitimate worry that you anger your base and they don't show up in a midterm election year.
It's really depressing, the idea that because Democrats have been winning on this issue, because Latinos were so upset with the Republicans last time around, that they would delay it just for winning seats.
But in all fairness, they may say there is an argument to be made. While some may say you get your foot in the door in a big time way and then you fix it, others argue you only get one shot per generation on something as big as this, and they don't want to blow it. I mean, I don't think it's purely politics.
Well, we haven't done anything in decades on immigration. Let's move on.
Until we learn to redraw the House districts, though, it is almost inconceivable to see a Democratic House after the 2014 elections. I would say it's almost impossible unless something dramatic changes. And so then if the Democrats somehow keep the White House in 2016, do they get the House back? Does Hillary Clinton have those big of a coattails? And then can you pass immigration reform? I see that Washington too closely divided, no matter what happens in the next 2, 4, 6 years, that if the opportunity's there, take it.
Wow. Listen to John King talking about Hillary Clinton's coattails.
I know.
That was pretty impressive, John King. Hey, let's move on to these so-called MIRA things. The president talked about this in the State of the Union address, the creation of these new employer-sponsored savings accounts to help people get started for saving for retirement, and they're called MIRA, small M-Y, big R-A, like to mimic the IRA. Everybody's making fun of these. It's a big joke, John.
Look, I think anything you can do to help people, encourage people to save for their retirement is a good thing. This has become, forgive me, Mr. President, but sort of the school uniform argument that we had in the Clinton days.
Yeah.
The great when Bill Clinton was having his troubles, they came out with these small executive actions, including encouraging people to wear uniforms in schools, thinking it would help with discipline and the like. A lot of people say it's not a good plan because it relies largely on Treasury notes and, the interest rate on those, if you have any in your 401k or if you happen to buy them, pretty miserable the last few years. You're not, you're better off to buy the sort of the S&P 500, index fund than you are to buy Treasury notes. And a lot of Republicans say it's a non-starter because one of the ways the president wants to pay for it is to make more affluent people, lose some of the tax-deferred benefits they get for their retirement. There's two pieces of this. If it starts a conversation about what can you do to help more people save, I think it's great. The way it is now, there's not a lot of support for it in the Republican Party, and a lot of Democrats think it's modest. I'm not going to say they think it's a gimmick, but they think it's too modest.
John, we're going to borrow a couple of topics we liked from your Sunday morning show, if you don't mind. One of the questions that was asked, and I think partially answered, why was Mitt Romney at the Super Bowl? Was it because he loves the Seahawks defense, because he loves Peyton Manning? What's the answer to that question? Is it really possible? I know he's leading in the most recent, I think it's the Purple Strategies poll. He's leading in New Hampshire amongst Republicans, even though he's not a candidate. Is this even marginally plausible for 2016?
I view it as a very, 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 very unlikely possibility. However, he misses the spotlight. He misses being involved in public life. And I think most of that is a benefit to him. I'm not endorsing Mitt Romney. I think he wants to be a public servant, and he enjoys being part of the debate. Some of that is ego. You don't run for president. You have a healthy ego to compete at that stage. Some of it, I think, is the guy. He's wealthy, and he wants to give back in some way, and he wants to be part of the debate. Good for him. I bet he probably wishes he didn't run in 2008. Because then you could see another Romney run. It's really hard to see Mitt Romney running again. But here's why people are talking about it. Because Chris Christie was the next, he was the second coming or the third coming, and now he's viewed by a lot of people as potentially damaged goods. So they're all running down to Jeb Bush and saying, only a Bush can beat a Clinton. And Jeb Bush is saying he's being much more open about it. Now he's talking about an actual timetable. He's setting up a process. He says if you run, you have to be joyful about it and be an uplifting candidate, not be negative. But most people think in the end Jeb will say no. And so there are some, establishment type, Romney type, Wall Street type, Christie-type Republicans who don't like Ted Cruz and don't like Rand Paul and don't think Scott Walker can beat Hillary Clinton, who are saying, well, if we lose Christie and we lose Jeb, who's it going to be? And I'm told that Romney has had a couple of conversations with people like, really? Are you sure? Huh? They're talking about this? But they're not doing anything. They're not organizing. They're not picking up the phone. They're not calling people saying, wait for me. And so I think, look, 2 weeks ago, the odds of Mitt Romney running again were zero. I think maybe they're one now.
Speaking of odds,
his wife will never do it.
Well, from the film, you would suggest that's the case, nor his kids. You know, speaking of odds, I've now counted up. You've said when they run against Hillary Clinton about 11 times in the 15 minutes we've been talking. Should I be running to Las Vegas and making a proposition, one of those proposition bets? I mean, you're talking, and you're a pretty careful guy with your words, John King. You're talking like this is an absolute slam dunk that she's the Democratic nominee. How close is she to announcing that she's doing this thing?
It is until it isn't, right? look, the infrastructure built up around her is extraordinary and beyond unprecedented. I've been doing this for nearly 30 years. There's never been anything like this. Really? There have been front runners before, but you have all of the giant Democratic donors, all of the big Democratic strategists who have not retired, including the people who just got Barack Obama reelected president, including people who have been loyal to the Clintons for 20 and 30 years, and including a whole bunch of other people saying, you know, if she runs, we're for her. And they're building not a 50 state, but the 30 states that the Democrats plan. They're building an infrastructure in all those states. They're building a financial network. They're essentially building her this, you know, new high-speed rail train. All she has to do is put on a little conductor cap and step on board. I just want to say this. Who's going to beat her? Now, she's been inevitable before. So if I'm Hillary Clinton, this makes me pretty nervous because she was inevitable in 2007.
Yeah, she was.
And she thought there was this, you know, this cute kid from Illinois who was going to be somebody someday came along, and he happens to be the president of the United States right now. So anybody can be beat. But Elizabeth Warren's not going to challenge Hillary Clinton. Kirsten Gillibrand's not going to challenge Hillary Clinton. Amy Klobuchar's not going to challenge Hillary Clinton. Deval Patrick apparently isn't going to challenge Hillary Clinton.
Joe Biden is not going to challenge Hillary Clinton.
Joe Biden is not going to. We had that race. I have so much respect for Joe Biden as a man and as a politician. Yeah. I think he is so, forgive me, George W. Bush misunderstood. I have a lot of respect for Joe Biden, and he's got great support. Watch him this year. You're going to see a lot more Joe Biden and Bill Clinton on the road this year than you are Barack Obama trying to help Democrats. If he can go into a labor union, he can go into the Erie Pub and have a beer, and the guys leave happy. But we had that race in 2008. Obama won, Clinton came in a close second, and Biden disappeared. How do you see it being any different this time? Just because he's been vice president for 8 years. I just don't. You know, she's the only reason generationally I think the American people would go backwards, the only reason she could win is because it would be another first. You'd be electing the first one. Look, there's just nothing out there that shows me somebody can beat her. Now, does some issue come to light? Do we learn something about Benghazi we don't know? You know, look, keep your eyes wide open. And you trust me, she's keeping her eyes wide open because, again, she's been anointed before only to have the mountain collapse. But look around and you tell me who's going to beat her.
Hey, speaking of who's going to beat her, one last thing. You also brought this up on your show this past weekend. Dead heat in New Hampshire between a sitting United States senator and a guy who hasn't even announced whether he's running or not. The senator is Gene Shaheen. The guy who hasn't said whether he's running is Scott Brown. It seems to me, John, that the longer he waits and the higher his poll numbers go, the more impossible it is for this guy to say no, or else he is persona non grata in the Republican Party forever because he's essentially frozen the field. That's a legit opinion, is it not?
It is. I talked to somebody in New Hampshire last night who says that some other Republicans who were not even thinking about this race now see Shaheen, mainly because of the president and Obamacare, as much more weak than they thought. And so other Republicans are starting to think about it. So Scott Brown better be careful. He better not wait too long. The party up there might get annoyed with him. And he's already, you know, taking up a new state. If you talk to people who've spent some time with Senator Brown lately, they tell you a couple of things. Number one, in the back of his mind, he has this, I want to be president in his head. And again, that's admirable. If you can tell me how Scott Brown can win the nomination of this Republican Party after what Mitt Romney just went through, I mean, the party's changing, but it's changing and it's moving to the right and the libertarian wing. It's not moving Scott Brown's way. But he seems to think he can be president. And I don't mean that to sound as dismissive as I just said it, because sometimes people surprise us. But I've covered this for a long time, and I don't see Scott Brown's path to the Republican presidential nomination.
Do you say that because you heard that he had his dog on the roof from Wrentham to New Hampshire? You don't. Hey, John.
He did his Vladimir Putin plunge, and he came out shirtless. I mean,
he looked pretty good to me.
You know, John, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's just so I think that he's, part of him is thinking if I run in 14, I can't run in 16. So he has to deal with the 16 question first.
Yeah.
And then I was told a couple of weeks ago that Gail, his wife, was not so cool to this idea of him running again, but that she's starting to come around. And he had a conversation with somebody I know very well in the last week or so where he said, you know what, I also want to make some money, but I'm still young. That can wait a little bit. So they think he's warming to the Senate race, but they're not quite sure yet because he hasn't given them the green light.
By the way, for those who don't know, Gail is his wife, is a coworker of ours.
Yes, she is. She's upstairs
now
at this
WGBH,
morning.
So she
yes,
is there.
So you're an influential guy, John King from CNN. I've been calling the Shaheen people now for like 2 weeks to try to get, even like 2 seconds on the phone with Senator Shaheen about the Scott Brown challenge, and I can't even get a call back. Should I read something into that? What do you think? She's using him in all her fundraising. Every time you look at a fundraising thing for Gene Shaheen, there's Scott Brown, big as life, next to the Koch brothers half the time. What would you make of that?
I would read into that Gene Shaheen is actually, a gentlewoman in the sense that you'll get her on the phone to talk about Scott Brown, and I bet you'll also ask her, would you have President Obama campaign for you? How's Obamacare treating you up there in the state of New Hampshire? and she doesn't want to say what she would have to say because she's actually a class act and a nice person. Again, I'm not endorsing her politics. But if you look at what has happened, Mark Begich on State of the Union night came on CNN and said, Mr. President, sure, come to Alaska, not to campaign with me. I want to tell you how wrong you are. Mark Udall, Democrat of Colorado, a true gentleman, and he's been in politics. The Udall name is, the gold standard out in the West, and he's been in politics all his life. And he said, no, I don't really want the president anywhere near me. Democrats not only are distancing themselves from the president, if you ask them the question, they feel the need for campaign purposes to kick him. And so I'm assuming that she's laying low because she just has the good grace and doesn't want to have to answer those questions until she has to answer those questions.
Next time you talk to her, just say, give her Marjorie's number. Hey, before you go
she
away,
has it.
Your credibility is on the line here, John King, so answer carefully. The Broncos lost by 35 to the Seahawks. Would Tom Brady and company have made it any closer?
Closer, yes. But boy, did you see that team? Younger, stronger, faster, leaner, meaner, hungry. Wow. I hope the Patriots would have beat them, but that was an impressive performance. And I was not a fan of Pete Carroll when he was in our park. Boy, has he learned from his mistakes. And that's a team. I hope Tom Brady and company are back in the Super Bowl next year. And better study a lot of Seattle game filming because they might be there again.
Hey, John, great to talk to you. Thanks so much. Good luck with the show. It was a great kickoff last Sunday.
John King.
Patrick, guys.
Yeah. Thank you, John. John is CNN's chief national correspondent and also the host of the brand new, and it's really terrific. I love those panel discussions. Inside Politics, you can catch it every Sunday morning at 8:30 on CNN. When we come back, we're going to ask you about the Woody Allen paradox. Can you separate the man from his art? Is it time to boycott his films? Or is it okay to decouple his work from his personal life and the latest very upsetting allegations? That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Beth Daly is a reporter with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
WGBH is a perfect fit for us. It is a young newsroom. It has lots of energy. It has TV. It has radio. And it has really smart people with really great ideas that we hope to collaborate on.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now a partner with WGBH News.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum presenting STIR, an adventurous mix of contemporary art, music, and performance, featuring Calathumpian Consort on February 6th. Tickets at gardnermuseum.org/music. And Fox Hill Village of Westwood, providing retirement living and cooperative ownership to active seniors for over 20 years. Now including White Oak Cottages, its new concept in memory care. FoxhillVillage.com and WhiteOakCottages.com.
Look, Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I assume you've all read this, the open letter written by Dylan Farrow, the daughter of Mia Farrow, and she's writing about Woody Allen. What's your this is a quote. What's your favorite Woody Allen movie? Before you answer, you should know. From there, she goes on to describe how Woody Allen sexually abused her when she was 7 years old. She ends her letter by writing these words. So imagine your 7-year-old daughter being led into an attic by Woody Allen. Imagine she spends a lifetime stricken with nausea at the mention of his name. Imagine a world that celebrates her tormentor. Are you imagining that? Now, what's your favorite Woody Allen movie? That written by Dylan Farrow. And we want to know, I guess, for starters, what is your favorite Woody Allen movie? And is that okay? Can you separate Woody Allen's art from his actions? Is it fair to appreciate what he does professionally if you clearly don't approve of what he is alleged to have done personally? And by the way, for purposes of this discussion, we're not going to get into, is Dylan Farrow's story the legit one, or is Woody Allen's defense the legit one? For purposes of this discussion, let's assume that Dylan Farrow is speaking the truth. What reaction do you have if you've traditionally been a Woody Allen fan? You know, our number is 877-301-8970. A lot of people with whom I've had this discussion, because, you know, in the early years, I was a huge Woody Allen fan. Some of his later movies I like a lot. Some people are comparing this to the Sun Yi situation when she, the adopted daughter of Mia Farrow. She was 19. Woody Allen was 56 at the time the Allen and Farrow broke up. As troubling as I find that to be, and I find it really troubling, it is nothing next to the allegations that are being made by Dylan Farrow. And you say to yourself, if one believes, particularly if you live in a place like this that lived through the sex abuse crisis in the Catholic Church, assuming that what Dylan Farrow says is true, how do you go lay down $15 or whatever it is to see a Woody Allen movie? And by the way, my understanding is the Academy Award voting for Cate Blanchett for Woody Allen, I think original screenplay, I'm not sure, I believe starts this Friday. What kind of impact is that going to have, and should it have? So we want to know at 877-301-8970, what's your reaction to the art of Woody Allen as a result of the alleged personal behavior of Woody Allen? Not terribly long ago, 877-301-8970.
You know, the later movies like Blue Jasmine, which was absolutely terrific, and Cate Blanchett was the performance was just incredible. Don't have him in them. Midnight in Paris did not have Woody Allen in them. But so I'm hoping that because he's not on the screen in front of you, you can kind of still enjoy them. But when you think of the movies he was in, you know, Annie Hall, Manhattan, Husbands and Wives, Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Well, stop on Manhattan for a section.
Yeah, Manhattan was when he was a...
What was the story?
He's a 40-something year-old man carrying on with a 17-year-old high school girl, Mariel Hemingway. And, you know, for some reason, when we saw it, and that came out, what, in the early 80s, I believe? You know, it wasn't like, oh,
78.
Thank you very much, John Parker.
John
Parker's encyclopedic memory for these kind of facts. Okay, 78. I remember seeing it and not thinking, God, that's really creepy. But then, of course, you found out that in real life, the real Woody Allen was involved with someone who was barely out of high school, the adopted daughter of his longtime girlfriend, whom he watched grow up, which is the other really creepy thing.
I agree with you.
So that turned me off for a while on Woody Allen movies. But then I kind of came back. And now, you know, it's unbelievable how upset I am about this because I watch Hannah and Her Sisters every Thanksgiving.
I know you do.
It's become a family tradition.
Annie Hall is my favorite movie.
And so do I watch Hannah and Her Sisters next Thanksgiving with my kids. He's in it.
But you know, the conversation. By the way,
it.
I agree with you. And also, whether he's in Midnight in Paris or the Blue Jasmine, he makes money if it turns out one patronizes his film. So I think I agree with you. It's much more visceral when you see his face, his body in this thing. But we do, as we were discussing upstairs with Chelsea, our colleague, we do have, it's sort of like selective enforcement. Remember the shows we did when we found out that there were young workers, literally slaves in some of these apple plants over there in China. Some workers jumping off roofs to their suicide. The way we rationalize this, I have to say, as well, we did research, and a lot of these other companies making alternatives manufacture their goods in these sweatshops in China, too. But everybody, you know that
Here's
that's a phony
Here's
distinction.
Here's the difference. you go to the movies, although I just saw Llewyn Davis and was so depressed, I was ready to kill myself at the end of the movie. But anyway, you go to the movies for enjoyment or to watch a great piece of art. It's an entertainment experience that you choose. And when there, every movie he makes now, you think of what he's done in his private life. It's different. You don't sit in front of your computer with images of people having these terrible lives in China.
But
or
should you?
Else.
But should you?
You probably should, but I don't think you do. I mean, you're not thinking about sweatshops every time you sit down and check your email. But I think now when you go to the movies, to Blue Jasmine or whatever else, you think of the guy that made this and the
so
images.
So would you go? Would you, assuming, again, for purposes of the discussion, because we really don't know, even though I think they're the, most of the people whom I respect say there's a lot of trappings to what Dylan Farrow says that give it a lot of credibility. But putting that aside for the moment, assuming that the allegations are true, do you ever go see a Woody Allen movie again?
Well, I said I wouldn't go see one after the Sun Yi thing, and I went back, so I don't know if I can be...
But this is much more, I mean, as you said yourself, it's much more egregious than...
It's much worse. Let me say this for sure. I can't enjoy them the way I did. I just can't enjoy them the way I did. It's really, really terrible. And by the way, we're getting emails about a Daily Beast piece that was written by a man who did a documentary on Woody Allen that poo-pooed a lot of these allegations. I've read that. I've also read the Maureen Orth, the piece that she did on Dylan Farrow.
And she's the former wife of Tim Russell,
yes,
right?
Yes, I put a lot more credibility in the Maureen Orth reporting than I do in the reporting of the guy who did the documentary about Woody Allen. So, Barbara, thank you. But I think you should read Maureen Orth's piece as well.
Well, you also, I mean, again, we said we wouldn't get into this. I'm sure you've seen the video of the prosecutor from Connecticut saying there was probable cause, but he decided not to proceed because he didn't want to do further damage to the young girl.
That's not
in this
unusual.
Case. Yeah.
That happens all the time in child abuse cases because the child.
No, but then you compare that to the fact that some of the agencies that investigated said there wasn't probable cause. The point is, we're not going to resolve this on the radio, nor should we try. But it highlights the issue about whether or not you can separate the professional work of somebody. What did you say Jim Vernier said in your paper before we get
well,
the calls?
Well, he said, and it was a great point. He
he's
said,
a movie
well, suppose
reviewer.
We found, he's a movie reviewer, and he wrote a great piece today in the Herald. So suppose he found out Beethoven, had committed. Terrible things. And that's a good point. Lots of people say that's basically the question. Can you separate the art from the artist?
By the way, it wouldn't have any effect, on people's appreciation of the music because you don't see him. I mean, I'm getting back to your
well,
point.
Also
the reason this is so
ago.
Visceral is because you've not only seen Woody Allen on the screen interminably, but Manhattan is one of my favorite movies. I mean, the music is beautiful. The imagery is someone who lived in New York for 15
years. It's ruined
years,
for me.
You can never see. I mean, he's essentially a predator. I rationalize the Sun Yi thing, even though I'm appalled by him there. The facts are not in dispute. But I've seen it since, and I probably until this last week would have seen it again. But
how much did you like Midnight in Paris?
I loved Midnight
Owen,
in Paris.
What's his name? Owen, the blonde kid.
Yeah.
Owen Murphy. Is that something?
No,
his
not
name?
Owen Murphy.
Whatever
I'm
his
not
going to
tell you what it is.
He was.
Now,
thank
don't
you.
Tell her, John.
Owen Wilson. It was terrific.
That was a great movie.
And Blue Jasmine was terrific. And Vicky Cristina Barcelona, whatever it was terrific, too.
877-301-8970. We've been rambling on. It's now your turn. Let's go to Margaret. You're in Providence. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Thanks, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, guys. This is my first time calling.
Well, thank you very much for doing it. I hope you do it again
and
soon.
And I really appreciate, I really like your show.
Thank you.
But this topic moved me. I have not seen a movie of Woody Allen since Sun Yi, and I would not see it just because of that. I find that to be child molesting at any age because he was 56, she was his child. I find that incest. It's like incest. He was. I can't understand why anybody would want.
Well, technically, she wasn't his child. She was the child of Mia Farrow and Andrew Previn.
Yeah,
she
but
was
she
the
was
child
a little...
of his girlfriend.
Right, but I think the point that I assume Margaret's not talking in a legal sense,
right.
But you mean, and the point that Marjorie made, I think on air, maybe you made it off air a couple of minutes ago, that not only did he connect with her when she was 19 and he was whatever he was, but he
watched
was in the household
yes.
When she was a little girl. And so that's what did it to you, Margaret, I assume, yes?
Because he was acting like a father figure.
Yes.
And it's wrong, and I believe. Dylan, I believe her wholeheartedly.
Margaret, is there anybody else's private misbehavior that has caused you to boycott his or her work like that of Woody Allen?
No.
Okay.
Not that I can remember. I mean, he just, it just irked me.
Comes through in your voice.
I have not seen one of his movies, and will not see one of his movies. I've seen Manhattan, but I will never revisit any of his films.
Hey, Margaret, we hope you call us again soon. It was a very powerful first call. Thanks so much for making it.
You know, there was a great piece. I think it was either in Slate or Salon a year or so ago about Alec Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And Alec Baldwin, of course, who was also in Blue Jasmine. He was terrific in Blue Jasmine. Screamed at his kid on the phone. And there was a recording of it. And she was 11 or 12 at the time. And it was just vicious. And
he's disgusting.
He's done very many kind of unsavory things since then. But the Slate piece was saying, I feel so guilty about how much I love to watch Alec Baldwin. How when I see him on Saturday Night Live, I'm hysterically laughing. When I saw him on 30 Rock, I loved him. And, you know, that was pretty awful, too.
Well, beyond the kid thing, he denies it, this racial tirade against somebody in East Village, the homophobic stuff.
Yeah. But do you turn off the TV when Alec Baldwin is the host of Saturday Night Live?
No, but you know, when you're discussing it here, and I think about it at the time when I see him, and I do love it, it's hard to defend. I mean, where do you draw the line? You now say if the allegations of Dylan Farrow are true, then that's the line. Okay, well, how much further does the line go? What kind of behavior disqualifies you from appreciation and cultivation by the public?
I mean, he was great in that movie with Meryl Streep, too.
He was.
Meryl Streep co-starred with him.
Well, Woody Allen's been great in a lot of things, too.
Of the movies.
No,
the Madonna of the movies, Jim.
You know, one of the most powerful things, which we didn't read, if you haven't read the Dylan Farrow thing, you really do have to read the underlying letter. When she calls out by name the people who star in Blue Jasmine, and then she specifically calls out Diane Keaton,
yes,
saying, "You knew me since I was a little girl." That is stuff that is really, really powerful. Let's go to Ann in Acton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Ann.
Hi. I would not watch a Woody Allen movie. I haven't watched one since he, what I call, molested what I feel was his daughter, even though she was not technically his daughter, mm-hmm, but he lived in the same house that she did.
Well, they lived across the park from...
They lived across the street.
Across the park.
But I also do not go to Mel Gibson because of what he said, nor Charlton Heston because of his NRA.
Well, here's a woman of principle.
You're an impressive woman, Anna. You're a better person than I am, that's for sure.
And by the way, who's the second person? Who's the second person you mentioned, Anne? Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson.
And he did anti-Semitic rants and other sorts of things. And by the way, I think you were you're not alone in that. A lot of people had that kind of reaction as well. Anne, thank you so much for the call. You know, she mentions the Charlton Heston thing. I'm not exactly a supporter of the NRA. That is a place where I have not drawn the line. The fact that somebody has different politics than I do, even on something that matters as much as gun control, that has not been a dividing line for me. But personal behavior that is so abhorrent. And you almost put yourself, you know, when you say Dylan Farrow, how would you feel if you were the victim of any of this kind of behavior when you're the world? Like when Diane Keaton got up and not only celebrated when Woody Allen, I don't even remember what the award show was, that he got the award recently, Golden Globes, then she sang a little ode to Woody Allen at the end, and I was watching it and smiling. I mean, there are a lot of legitimate
things. I think it's a very common thing in human nature to think you have a friend, you know them, you've known them for a long time, you cannot imagine this person doing what they did. And I think that's probably what Diane Keaton's perspective is. But I'll never forget covering the trial of a priest named Paul Shanley, who was convicted of just gruesome child molestation. He was then about 70, I think, when the trial went on. And he was a very charismatic, very good-looking, even in his older years, very charming guy. I'm sure you would go out and have a cup of coffee with this man or know him really well and have no inkling that he could do. And he was allegedly molesting dozens of kids who would go pick on runaways that were down, you know, by the bus station in Boston. You wouldn't believe he could do it. And I think that's probably, you know, people don't drool and run around in trench coats that are child molesters.
Well, so when you see, but the Woody Allen stories, I mean, this has been out there for a long time. I mean, the original allegations in the Farrow case were, what, in the early 90s? And then there was the Sun Yi thing. So these things have been around him, unlike, for example, what you said about Shanley prior to him actually having been accused of what he was ultimately convicted of. Let's go to Worcester, where Alex is on the phone. We're talking about Woody Allen. Would you patronize? Would you go see a Woody Allen movie after what you heard this week? Hi, Alex.
Hey, Jim and Margie. I'm also a first-time caller, so
well,
thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. We really appreciate it.
you know, this is something that it's not just with the Woody Allen situation that I've been kind of revisiting with myself recently with the passing of Pete Seeger. I'm a first generation Cuban American, and you know, having seen what my family went through, you know, basically being expelled from their country, and to then to see folks, you know, a lot of folks in the entertainment industry support those types of regimes. You know, I've been asking myself that question in terms of, you know, do you support somebody, you know, who may be a tremendous artist or amazing musician or a great filmmaker, when you're so opposed to their whether it be political beliefs or in this case, which is even much worse, potential actions that somebody did.
And so, what's your answer, Alex? It sounds like your answer is no.
My answer is no. I think that by supporting them, you know, by basically putting money in Woody Allen's pocket, for example, or buying somebody's CDs or downloading their music and paying for it, you're basically enabling whatever it is that they're doing, whatever lifestyle choice that they've made, so or whatever crime they're committing. So,
you know, Alex, before you go away, I'm really embarrassed because I actually have seen Pete Seeger a lot of times and I know a lot about him. I don't know about the Castro connection. Briefly, what did he do with or about Castro?
He's been somebody, and you could research this pretty clearly.
No, I accept what you're saying. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's somebody who has been in support, you know, just like a lot of artists. I mean, you see that with movie stars and things like that who talk about the Castro regime, and you know, it has done some good things in terms of you know, healthcare for everyone, yeah, and literacy. But I always say it's great that your entire population is literate, but when you're determining what book they read or what they can study, and limiting those rights, then you're not really doing justice to humanity. So, but I would definitely encourage folks to look at that. I mean, he spoke out in favor of an oppressive regime.
Alex, thank you. Another fine first call. Thanks. We hope you do it again soon, Alex. Thanks.
Squeezing one more?
Yeah, let's do it.
Jacqueline in Boston. What do you think, Jacqueline?
Yeah, I did have a favorite Woody Allen film. It was Purple Rose.
By the way, Purple Rose of Cairo.
Calling,
yeah,
you. Yeah, it's my first time calling you, and I do enjoy
you.
Your show.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
But as I was telling your screener, I look for the artist in the art. When I read, I look for the author, and it's not always there. And, of course, it's not obvious. In a great artist, it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But they should reveal something of themselves and in their art, and I always look for that, and I always love and enjoy that, and I cannot do that with a Woody Allen film. He's been right out there revealing his wants and deep desires and, you know, fantasies to us for years and years, and we've kind of gone along with it because he's wonderful in the way that he does it, but he's gotten a little heavy-handed at times. He's been a little obvious, and now it's really not something I can watch.
So is it the Dylan Farrow thing that was the final straw, for lack of a better expression? Is that what you're saying, Jacqueline? You were troubled by it in the past, but this is where
Yeah, I haven't been watching his stuff for quite a while, yeah, and but this was the capper. This is the moment when I say, okay, it's a conscious decision now. I'm never going to watch another one of his things.
Jacqueline, another fine first call. Thank you so much. Three first calls
in
a row that were really impressive.
Very principled people.
Yeah, don't say what you're saying. I'll think next. No, I mean, this is a real conundrum. I mean, and I have to say, there's no, you know, on my desk, it will be turned down today. Shannon Ogden, my former colleague at NECN, gave me an autograph of Woody Allen. It's one of the few things that's actually on my desk at NECN, and it won't be after today. I mean, this is too much by a long shot.
Okay, up next, we are going to talk with Charlie Baker. He's going to talk about his run for governor. A conversation with the Republican candidate is up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Music to end a siege.
You owe it to yourself to be playing, and you owe it to the world to keep your voice as loud as possible.
A clarinet player teams with the Shostakovich Leningrad Symphony to convey the pain of the people of Syria. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy. all through your life. You can learn more at LeahyHealth.org. That's LeahyHealth.org. And Bentley University. Bentley University Center for Career Services is the reason that within 6 months of commencement, over 95% of Bentley graduates have either been hired or accepted to graduate programs. Bentley, the business university.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We're continuing our two-on-one conversations with gubernatorial candidates. Here with us in Studio 3 today is Charlie Baker. Charlie was the gubernatorial Republican nominee in 2010. He's aiming to reclaim that status and take his candidacy all the way back to the State House. Charlie, good to see you again.
Good day, guys. How are you?
Hi, Charlie Baker. Good to see you. Good to see you. So the Herald and Suffolk University had some new polling come out this morning that had
And it always is about the horse race. Yes, isn't it?
Well, I want to get to a very serious topic in a minute, but it is breaking news.
By the way, we had a bet this morning how long it would take until you said, when are we going to talk about policy?
Yeah, exactly.
It took you 2 seconds. Yeah. That's an all-time
record.
Good
for me. All right.
But this is a brand new Boston Herald poll. I also work at the Boston Herald, and it came out this morning, so we want to be on top of the news. Anyway, you were down by 13 points to Martha Coakley, the Attorney General. What do you make of that?
As I have said many times and will continue to say, the only poll that really matters is Election Day.
Okay.
And I learned that the hard way in 2010.
I have a better answer for you.
Okay, what is it?
Wasn't Scott Brown 20, 30 points behind Martha
16.
Coakley? And
16
what happened to him?
Yeah,
who
exactly.
won that race?
Well, in that race, the poll that really mattered was the one on Election Day. I'm very happy with the response we're getting from voters out there. Doesn't matter what their stripe is. People are really interested in having somebody with real-world private sector as well as public sector experience on Beacon Hill. People want somebody who knows something about healthcare and can deal with the sort of mess that's been created by the Health Connector and the federal healthcare reform here in Massachusetts. And people want somebody who can be a check on the legislature. And I think I pretty much check all those boxes.
So let's delve into policy deeply. Do you know Jeff McCormick?
I have never met Jeff McCormick.
Speaking one more political thing up front, he's on the front page of the Herald today. He's announcing today, tomorrow, independent, apparently loaded. He's going to invest significantly in his
loaded
own campaign.
Loaded financially?
Loaded financially. Right. And in the brief description, I have to admit, I know absolutely nothing about him. We're interviewing him tomorrow afternoon. Is it sounds like the sort of Weldian, Bakerian, socially liberal-leaning, fiscal conservative thing. Does that not make you a little bit nervous about somebody with deep pockets who's got at least a little of your M.O.?
I'm running for governor, and I plan to continue to run for governor, and I'm going to make my case to the voters on what I believe we can do to increase jobs and improve our economy, and as I've talked to you before, close the achievement gap in schools, make higher ed less expensive, and create great communities. And I, you know, my view on this is very simple, which is I'm going to communicate and talk to people about my message, collect data and information from them as I wander around the state and have a chance to engage with voters. And I think come Election Day, we'll do just fine.
Well, let's move on to some policy stuff. The same poll I mentioned, Boston Herald poll, Suffolk University poll, said 70% of Massachusetts.
Did you count how many times she says Boston Herald during the
That's right. I know where my bread is buttered. At least half of it anyway. 70% of Massachusetts voters think there's a system-wide failure at the Department of Children and Families. You had a lot of experience back when you were in Bill Weld administration, supervising what was then the Department of Social Services. And I know you feel passionate about this. So give us a couple of ideas of how Charlie Baker, the governor, would fix the Department of Children and Families.
Well, the second these stories broke, I said that I issued sort of a 6-point plan. And I hate talking about point plans because everybody thinks it's cliched. But it basically said there are 6 key elements to measuring how the department is doing and taking care of kids by region. And the reason I said that is everybody thinks about this agency as sort of a big blob. And the way to really go at this is to say, what's going on in Region 1? What's going on in Region 2? And then finding the places where you have problems, which would come up if you actually did some of this work and made this information available, and then go after it. Because I do believe that, you know, we do have a systemic problem here. The second thing I would say, and we issued a statement on this morning, the state, the governor, the attorney general should stop fighting this suit, which clearly raised a whole series of significant problems, systemic, at the department last year, and start engaging in settlement discussions. We should get out of the business
of
trying...
Tell people about this suit. It's a federal suit brought by a
Children's
Welfare
Group.
Yes.
And they basically laid out a case and used a whole bunch of really sad and troubling and disturbing cases to make their point about the fact that Massachusetts was failing kids. and Massachusetts chose to fight them and to, you know, move the case from one court to another, went shopping for a judge, did all this stuff, and ended up getting a dismissal of the case. Although if you read the opinion, and basically what the judge says is these cases are horrible. They just don't rise to some sort of judicially outrageous level. And from my point of view, the state, you know, that was followed up by two or three more stories about issues around deaths in the system since 2001, the handbook story that was written today. My view on this is really simple. When it comes to fixing, when it comes to dealing with kids under the state's care and custody, the goal here should be to stop fighting this stuff and start fixing it. And I think that we're heading in the wrong direction on this.
Well, one of the things that the judge did say in that opinion, which was really damning to the department and very upsetting, is that the Department of Children and Families has been chronically underfunded, not just for 2 years or 5 years, but for decades. And that he was really adamant. I believe his name was it Judge Young? I believe that was his name. He said, you know, look at yourselves in the face, taxpayers. You don't want this to happen, then pony up. What do you think about that, Charlie? That was his central argument. It's money.
Yeah, my central argument on this is maybe some of it's about money, but some of it's also about management and structure and focus and discipline and all those other good things that generate really great casework. And I go back to my original point here, which is the way to go at this is region by region, because this notion that the performance and the operation in every region and every agency and state government is the same is simply, basically, it's impossible, first of all. And secondly, that's not the way you should manage this. And we ought to figure out where the gaps are, both in management, delivery, service, money, and all the rest. But think about this region by region by region and use some of the standard measures for figuring this stuff out that people already know about. Like, when was the last time a kid was seen in every single region? What is the relationship between the police departments and the school departments in each region? Because the schools and the cops, as we know, are often the eyes and ears of the departments. I mean, this is sort of basic 101 casework stuff, and it hasn't been part of the conversation at all, which is why I think this fighting the case thing, fighting the court case, is the wrong way to go here.
Two quick things. When the commissioner testified in front of a legislative committee a couple of days ago, Representative Linsky said, can you state with assurance, and I'm paraphrasing, that there are no other Jeremiah Olivers, meaning nobody else is missing within the system? And she said, absolutely. Do you think she could credibly make that statement? Do you buy it?
First of all, I think that's setting the bar unbelievably low. Do we think there's no one else who's supposed to be under your care and custody who you can't find or locate? I mean, come on. We should be able to do better than that. I appreciate the point that the representative was trying to make. But my view on this is until the department comes out with something that specifically lays out where we are region by region by region, I don't think anybody really knows the answer to this question. And that's what's so terrifying and frustrating and worrisome to me.
Because there's vast differences among the different regions.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead, Charlie. Just a quick thing.
That Fitchburg story, people had talked about the fact that the Fitchburg office had issues for a while. Tons of grievances, all kinds of issues. I mean,
overstaffing,
it was an alarm
workers.
Bell going on there in that region for quite a while. And yet it took, you know, a horrible tragedy to actually raise this to the level where people actually did something about it.
But again, one of the things that got
Some of this is about preventing bad things from happening and not just responding to them when they do.
Well, let's talk about that if I can. Let me quote my second favorite pundit. That'd be Marjorie, by the way.
Who works for the Boston Herald.
A while ago, that essentially these social workers are first responders. They really are in so many ways. Even getting
working with those cops and school department
absolutely.
And teachers and administrators and all the rest.
Apart
yes.
From the larger funding question, you know, years ago prior to where we are today, in terms of individual social workers, I think the consensus between me and Marjorie, their salaries are pathetic. Where we're fighting in the mayor's race over this 25% increase for cops making $100,000, which they probably should make. Marjorie may not agree. These people are making 30, high 30, something like that. Would they make more under a Baker administration?
I would certainly take that into consideration. I think it's important. I also think the other thing we should be doing is creating master classes among social workers within state government. Some of these people are superstars, and we should be figuring out ways to leverage all they know and what they bring to the table and making them a bigger part of how we think about managing the department.
But taking it under consideration, I don't think it's that complex an issue that one has to think about it long and hard. You know what the numbers are, somewhere in the 30s.
Of them are there and some of them are elsewhere.
But you clearly know what the job is based upon your former...
I certainly think there are there are certainly issues associated with the way the department's funded. The thing I would hate to jump on right now is that is the only funding issue that they have to deal with that they face. I mean, one of the things I learned when I worked at Health and Human Services, admittedly a very long time ago, was that one of the biggest problems they had was getting support from lawyers for a lot of the work they needed to do to simply process cases in court. And they basically said to me point blank, they said, look, you can give us more social workers, but if we don't have more lawyers to actually get the stuff done, we need to get done to deal with what's going on in court, it's not really going to help us that much.
Yeah.
So sometimes you just have to be strategic about where you make your investments, that's all.
Did I mention that the Boston Herald had a poll today with Charlie Baker?
The Boston Herald, yeah. You did mention that.
We are talking with Charlie Baker, yeah, who's running for governor on the Republican side. The Herald also had a story today, a really upsetting story about foster parents. And, of course, when children are taken out of the home, if they can't put them with family members, and they put them in foster care. And apparently, if you have previously committed crimes involving soliciting prostitution, possessing obscene pornographic material, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, armed burglary, involuntary manslaughter, almost everything short of rape and murder and molesting a child, you can be a foster parent. I was stunned by this.
Yeah, so was I. And I say that as somebody who knows a lot of people who are foster parents, who are
great,
wonderful.
Yes, that's true.
Wonderful people.
That's true.
And I always worry in these conversations that we're going to overplay and simplify what's going on here. I'm speechless by what showed up in that story today. And obviously, I would hope that today that policy would change, because that's ridiculous on every level. But I do want to emphasize, I know a lot of foster parents who are
terrific,
who do magic work with kids.
Yeah, they
really do.
Charlie, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, one of the things you want to do if you're elected is you want to deal with this cost of higher education thing. We were railing yesterday about this thing Elizabeth Warren put out about the fact that the federal government made $66 billion over 5 or 6 years in profit on student loans. Congress has mostly dealt with the interest rate, which to me is just insane. The underlying cost is the issue. Give us the short version. What do you do as governor to make college more affordable?
I think one of the things we need to do is figure out how to create a 3-year type degree program, which you and I have talked about mm-hmm. before in this program. I think we need to leverage the online stuff and make it possible for kids to engage in sort of an online and classroom-based experience as they work their way through. And I think the state should lead the charge on that. The two other things I would say, we should figure out a way to leverage the work that Northeastern has done over the years with that co-op program.
Fabulous program.
But
real-world experience, for those who don't know, is integrated into the curriculum, which is just
and kids get,
brilliant.
Kids get jobs and they get paid while they're going to school. Yeah. And by the way, they are the standalone player in that space in Massachusetts. How can it be that we haven't figured out?
Right?
Yes. How can it be that we haven't figured out how to make that kind of a model something that we bake into what we do in the state system as well? And the final thing I'd mention, Jim, I really do want to. I've now been to a bunch of Voc Tech schools, and which do a real – today's Voc Tech school is nothing like the Voc Tech system that I knew when I was a kid. These places have really moved big time into the 21st century and provide a very effective education that is built and based around some opportunity associated with work for a lot of the kids who participate in them. We should be figuring out ways to connect those kinds of schools more closely to both community college, associate degree programs, and public higher ed as well as private higher ed, and figuring out some way to create an associate type track for kids. Because one of the things I've talked to a bunch of manufacturers who said to me, they have literally thousands of jobs open right now in Massachusetts. And the whole argument about matching those jobs to the skills of the people that are available, the big missing link in this is something that gets a Voc Tech kid a 2-year, 1-year associate degree so that they can get the training they need to get those jobs. And we need to do more to focus that kind of initiative.
The guy you ran against developed Patrick's prescription for that problem, because he's mentioned many times on the show how many open jobs there are at the same time that you have, a quarter of a million people unemployed. This is about a year or so ago. He proposed early in his first administration free community colleges to address that problem. Is that something that would be on your agenda?
This one is less about whether this is less an issue, in my opinion, about free community college and more about whether the college or the program is actually preparing the kid for the jobs that are available. And my view on this is if we can figure out a way to connect the educational experience to all those people, I mean, okay, how many years have we been talking about this and these jobs are still sitting out there open and available. I mean, if we can connect the job piece and the education piece together, either by, you know, getting a kid from a VocTech program into a junior college or community college that makes this work, I'm all for figuring out how to help the kid pay for it. But we've got to fix the curriculum piece first and make it relate more to what the employer community is looking for.
You know, we were just talking about foster care and the people that do great jobs and don't do great jobs. Boston Herald piece, I think I mentioned that. Anyway, there are other...
H-E-R-A-L-D.
That is correct. Yes. There are other ways to get involved if you can't make that kind of huge commitment to be a foster parent. And the Big Brother Association is one of them that you were involved in. And you have a great story about the young man that you were the big brother to when you were in college, right?
For 25 years, plus or minus.
Yeah, you stayed in touch. Yeah. So how did you get to be a big brother?
I wrote the phone number. I heard an ad on the radio, and I wrote the phone number down on my desk calendar at school back when we all had desk calendars when I was a freshman, and I stared at it for a while. And the phone number, I still remember what it was, 617-423-1715. And I finally got around to calling it, and I interviewed and went through the process, and they matched me with an 11-year-old kid who had a lot of issues and a lot of problems. And by the way, I actually talked about this in a video that's on YouTube, where the quality of the video is pretty bad, but I think the quality of the speech is pretty much me when it comes to the way I feel about mentoring and about Big Brother, Big Sister programs. They matter. They move kids. The biggest thing they do is they give kids who need it what I called in the speech I gave, a fan, somebody who will applaud and, you know, stand on the sidelines, help that kid, hell or high water, whatever it is, work their way through their problems and their issues. And many of these kids just don't have that. And whether you get it from a coach or a teacher or a neighbor or a parent, I don't much care. But a lot of those kids really need someone to sort of be there for them. And that was the part that
I read
the
piece on this in the Springfield Republican or one of those papers out west. What did the kid write on his either when he graduated or so? What
when he graduated from high school, and his trip through high school was really something. It was like an Indiana Jones movie. He wrote, "Thanks, Chaz. Couldn't have done it without you."
God.
Which,
but he also said something else about the you versus the other people.
Yeah,
that,
you're right.
That he spent time with.
Yep.
When he was, what did he say?
After we'd been hanging out for a few years, he said to me one time that I was the only person who spent time with him who didn't get paid to do so. And I remember thinking, 12 years old,
that's a big deal.
What an insight. But it really got to the whole notion that he knew I was there, not because I had to be there or I was supposed to be there, but because I wanted to be there. And I think that's what makes those programs so powerful.
And you've kept in touch.
Yeah.
And he's doing okay?
We, you know, long story short, we aren't as in touch as we were 5 or 10 years ago, but we still chat.
Good.
Hey, Charlie, here's a quiz. You ready for a quiz?
Oh, God.
No, that's a good one. I'm going to read you a quote, and you have to tell me who said it.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to guess this. I agree with Governor Patrick that Massachusetts is a remarkable state with limitless potential, but also a place for whatever. Who said that? Was it Robert DeLeo, Terry Murray, or Charlie Baker? Who said that?
I'm going with C.
That would be Charlie Baker?
That would be Charlie Baker.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yes.
That would be right. Now, I'm assuming this is part of the you never got to know the real Charlie Baker, who's a much nicer guy than the Charlie Baker you didn't vote for. I mean, look at the look on his face. I wish we had a camera here. That is what it is, right? I mean, I know you relatively well. Do you have to force yourself to say those kinds of things? You go on to criticize him.
Of course
not. But by the
way,
your criticism is somewhat, while it's substantive, is muted. It's not an attack dog kind of thing. Are you conscious? I mean this really. Are you conscious this time about couching your criticism of either the Patrick administration or whoever the Democratic nominee is in a more, I don't know what the adjective is.
In other words,
has
he gone from pit bull to poodle?
Well, I know.
What he's asking you here.
That is, I guess that's, you are conscious of that, aren't you? Isn't that part of your thinking when you're speaking and writing and doing things in this campaign?
As I've said to you before, Jim, you know, I grew up listening to my mom, who's a Democrat, and my dad, who's a Republican, debate politics across the kitchen table all the time. And it was a very civil, informative, respectful dialogue. And as a guy who spent his whole career in healthcare and government as a Republican in Massachusetts, I always managed to get stuff done and get along with people. And I think part of getting along with people is acknowledging that most of the time we're all trying to achieve the same ends. What we're really going to end up arguing about is means.
Charlie Baker, when the the United States Attorney General announced that they were going
to
seek the
death
penalty.
But I'm glad to see that you're quoting me, Jim. That really, that's very helpful.
I've been quoting actually. I quoted you to Marjorie just this morning.
That's right.
She guessed it was DeLeo, by the way. I just wanted, but yeah. She was wrong. When the Attorney General Holder announced that they would seek the death penalty against Tsarnaev, I think it's fair to say that Deval Patrick, Marty Walsh, who was here with us the other day, Martha Coakley, did I say Coakley? And Deval
yes.
Patrick, who are opposed to the death penalty, danced a little bit, talked about they respect the process. You said right away the death penalty is the right thing for this guy. Two questions. One, why isn't life in prison without parole suffering and thinking about your misdeeds every day a harsher punishment? And two, what would you apply the death penalty to if you could craft a death penalty bill for Massachusetts?
Well, I think we're talking here about an act of terrorism, a heinous, horrible, cowardly act that not only maimed scores of people, but also killed many people, including children. And it was planned and perpetrated, and there's no doubt about who did it or why he did it. I mean, it's got all the elements, I think, of something that deserves sort of the ultimate punishment. My big concern about life without parole, and I think this is always everyone's big concern about life without parole, is maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. And that's always, I think, a question and issue in the back of people's minds. And
if you believe,
put it this way, I didn't have any trouble when they put Timothy McVeigh to death. That didn't bother me at all.
But if you believe that life without parole was life without parole, and there was no wiggle room, would you support it as an alternative to the death penalty?
I have no problem with having a system in which the prosecution can seek it if it believes that it's the appropriate punishment for the crime.
Should the state have a death penalty statute? Obviously, it was tried. It almost passed under Paul Cellucci.
Yeah, I mean, I support it, but it's not – I mean, on my list of things that I worry the most about, it's not, you know, it's not very – it's not a significant – let's put it this way. If you were to say to me, what are the five things I want to do to create safer communities – maybe even the 10 things I want to do, this isn't going to be one of them. There are a lot of things we should be doing to improve the safety of our communities and the safety of our citizens who live in some of our most dangerous communities. And I don't think for most of those people this would be, you know, on the top of their list.
Would one of those things be tougher gun laws, which appears to be what Speaker DeLeo is going to be proposing imminently?
I give the Speaker enormous credit for, you know, sort of not knee-jerking this issue and actually putting together a group to take a good hard look at this and coming up with a pretty comprehensive set of recommendations. And having looked through it, there's a bunch of things in it I can support, but I would like to have a chance to think about it in the larger context of what we already have pretty significant laws on the books, and I'd like to look at what we already have in the context of what's being proposed. I'll tell you one of the things, Jim, that would make a big difference in a lot of these places is we should stop cutting local aid. And when I talk about local aid, I mean general local aid, which is cops and firefighters, street
teachers.
Workers. Well, the education, they're in
Chapter 70, which is a separate
piece. But the bottom line here is you go to Brockton or Fall River or a lot of these mid-sized cities
in Massachusetts
that have big-time issues in a bunch of their neighborhoods, one of their biggest problems is their police forces are down significantly from where they were in 2007.
Did you see the Mitt Romney video?
I have not seen it yet. All I saw was
Netflix.
The trailer.
Yeah, okay.
I actually don't have a Netflix account.
You don't have Netflix. It's $7.
By the way, we learned from Brian McGrory, editor of The Globe. Was it Brian McGrory who told us? Who told us this the other day? You can get a free week. Who was the person who said that to us?
I think you can.
And then you can cancel.
But then you can't figure out how to cancel it.
But then you can watch every episode of House of Cards.
That's right. And the second season is coming up pretty soon. Okay.
I have not watched the
video. So even if – okay, you didn't see Mitt. If there was a movie – called Charlie.
That's right.
And one of the things that's great about Mitt is you get to see inside the family. You get to see him picking up. There's not garbage. What do you call this? Little trash
there's
on the
balcony.
Rug.
There's a balcony outside the hotel room, and then there's a present that was opened up, and he goes out and he picks up all the trash in kind of a Mike Dukakis-esque fashion, you know, cleaning it all up around the house.
So what would we learn? I'm serious. What would we learn about you that nobody knows about you except Lauren and your kids and your close friends?
Around my house, you mean?
Well, in your life.
Just in my life.
Something that, yeah.
If I don't have to put on, like, real clothes, I don't.
What are unreal clothes, for example? Give us an example.
I'm perfectly capable of wandering around all day long in either pajamas and a sweatshirt or, you know, a sweatshirt and sweatpants. And I'm not one of those people who thinks I have to, like, get dressed when I get up.
Are you an L.L. Bean pajama kind of guy, or do you have special pajamas?
I have absolutely. I have whatever my, you know, my wife bought for me and gave me for Christmas.
Can I tell you something? If you're trying to soften that image of yours, wear pajamas to your next event.
I'm
serious.
The plaid pajamas.
Hey, Charlie, before you go away, you've been very kind with your time. We've discussed with you, you used to be a regular here until you decided to do what you're doing. One of the things we talked about.
And by the way, you should know a lot of people listen to your show because I hear that.
I hear that all the time. That's great.
Hey, Charlie, one of the things that we are obsessed with that we've talked about your position on through the years is the whole casino thing. And I think the last time we talked to you as a candidate, correct me if I'm wrong, you said that if the SJC says that the Supreme Judicial Court says the repeal of the casino law could go to the ballot, I believe you said last time that you'd consider supporting it. Did you not?
That's what I said.
Has that evolved anywhere? Where are you now?
I'm pretty much in the same place. I still, what I said to you before was what I still believe, which is I want to see a little more about where this all plays out. But the thing I did say when you and I talked about this before is I see no reason why it shouldn't be on the ballot. And I think the arguments that are being made about why it's not ballot worthy don't make any sense to me. The idea that there's some implied contract here around a process in which you could participate and end up with nothing at the end, I don't understand why the notion that someone submitting an application and engaging in the conversation and paying the fee creates an implied contract makes no sense to me at all.
Do you also support the notion of, in terms of voters getting a right to speak on something, the likelihood of there being the third step in the marijuana ballot series here in Massachusetts
in 2016? The Boston Herald poll says the majority of voters now support.
Legalization of marijuana. One, do you support it being on the ballot? And two, would you vote for it?
I always support putting stuff on the ballot.
Would you vote for it?
I'm a big direct democracy guy. I will probably vote against it.
You would. Charlie Baker, it's a pleasure.
It's good to see you
guys.
Nice
to see you. Hope
to
see you again soon.
Good to see you, too. Thank you very much for coming
in. I'm looking forward to discussing Boston Herald polls all year long.
We could have done that endlessly. Actually, we did do it endlessly.
We did do it endlessly.
I'm sure you will.
David Paleologos from Suffolk.
What's your website, Charlie?
CharlieBaker2014.com.
Charlie, thanks.
Thanks. Charlie Baker is running for governor of Massachusetts on the Republican ticket. Coming up next, we're going to ask all you bibliophiles about extreme reading. Are you ready to have your books tricked out with soundtracks? Do you like the notion of your book being scored? How about wearing a sensory vest that actually manipulates your body so that you really feel what the book's protagonist is feeling? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Next time on The World, a passion for ephemera.
You know, there's a sense now for many people that everything has already been collected. Everything is being digitized. It can be found on Google Books. And people are realizing that this just isn't true.
Dealers now offer old leaflets, posters, and handbills from Stalin's Russia and Chairman Mao's China, collecting history that most people threw away. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Boston Symphony Orchestra, led by David Newman, playing Bernstein's West Side Story score live with the new remastered film, February 14th through 16th. More information at bso.org. And AAA Southern New England, helping and serving members for more than 110 years, with roadside assistance, insurance and financial products, and a full-service travel agency. Details at aaa.com. AAA, membership for life.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. According to Slate.com, which Marjorie and I are reading, reading is going extreme. Today, e-readers and audiobooks seem downright quaint compared to what's called immersive reading. What that means is this new technology that guarantees a movie-like experience by giving your book, literally, a soundtrack. Even more severe, I'd never heard of this till I read this piece, sensory fiction. That involves what you know, is sort of like, looks like a suicide vest full of sensors, which actually manipulate you physically as a way of simulating what the characters in the book are feeling. So does this appeal to you? Do you really want to feel what the, let's say, the Joads are feeling, Grapes of Wrath? Remember when they're working the peach orchards, Marjorie, and all the kids get dysentery? Do you want to feel that?
No.
Or how about Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses? Do you want to physically experience the pain that comes with riding horseback for miles with a few holes shot through your leg? This is all real, by the way. 877-301 8970, 877-301-8970. Does extreme reading appeal to you? What books would you like to have enhanced with a soundtrack, if any? What fiction would you like to have enhanced with a sensory vest? 877-301-8970. Now, let me just say, before I say that this has no appeal to me, it sort of defeats the whole purpose of the solitude and beauty of reading. And you're much more a reader than I, so you can speak to it better than I. If you had asked me 10 years ago, would I ever think of lying in bed with an e-reader instead of the tactile feel of a book, I would say not in your lifetime. And I don't think I've read a real book as opposed to an e-book in ages. So maybe this will grow me too. But the notion of a soundtrack and all this sensory feel is it's almost horrifying.
And you look ridiculous. You look like you're in a suicide vest. I mean, you have to go out and strap on your vest to read. Remember that girl with the dragon tattoo that was all the rage a couple of years ago?
I read all three of those.
Yeah,
actually,
they were great. I love those. You know, I don't think I want to be in that sort of perpetual state of panic and frenzy while I'm reading a book. It's just bad enough reading the book. You're nervous enough.
The people behind the sensory fiction thing talk about how you wear this tech apparatus that Marjorie and I were speaking about, quote, to experience the protagonist's physiological emotions. I mean, you know, the beauty of reading something is as much what you get from the page as what you put into the thing, right? I mean, the notion that they essentially create movies in books, which is what this is doing, it's almost horrifying to me.
They're talking about changing your heart rate.
I understand that.
Creating constriction through air pressure bags.
So you feel what the people in the books feel.
I don't think I want to have my heart pounding. I mean, anymore. You do get nervous reading books. I mean, that's why I mentioned The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. That was a very stressful book. You're stressed out.
There's a lot of violence. Yeah, horrible violence, actually. But it was, in any case, the number is 877-301-8970. Does any of this have any appeal to you, this extreme reading? Immersive reading is the more mild form. All you have is a soundtrack to your book, I guess, just playing in your ears. And then there's this sensory fiction, which to me is just completely ridiculous. I mean, if you want to go, as we said, you know, about if you want to go get dysentery and pick peaches, go pick peaches and get dysentery.
Oh,
but
God.
If you want to read Grapes of Wrath, just read Grapes of Wrath as it was written. I mean, really.
Okay, Pedro from Brighton. What do you think? Do you want to get one of these? You want to have one of these extreme reading experiences, Pedro?
Hey, Pedro.
I think so, but I think maybe it'll probably get a little bit better in a few years. As I'm sort of like an aspiring young author, and I think books are awesome, but it's just that words, as a way of conveying information, I think they're a little slow in comparison to, or inefficient compared to things like sound or visual and things of that nature.
So Pedro, instead of being a young aspiring writer, why aren't you a young aspiring filmmaker? That's what you want to do, isn't it?
It's a hard world to break into, but it's a world of dreams out there, you know.
what kind of writing are you doing?
Some fantasy fiction, thoughts of like morality, the absoluteness of the world, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Now, Pedro, you send us something you've written over here. What's our email address, Marjorie?
BPR@WGBHnews.org.
And not only can you send it over with a recommended soundtrack, and we'll do it and we'll report back to you. By the way, it's BPR@WGBH.org, but that was close enough.
Is that what I said?
No, you said sure, through a news thing. Pedro, good luck with the career, and thank you so much for the call. So there's one person
What's the email again, please?
BPR, mm-hmm. You know what that stands for?
Yes, I do. Boston Public Radio.
@WGBH.org.
Okay, thank you very much.
Now, you were close, though, and that's close.
Just got an naughty email from Art about 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, that's a perfect, we should have thought of that. Let's go to Michael. You're in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Michael.
Hi. I'm 21. I'm an avid reader. You know, I love to read, like, classic literature and stuff, you know? And I just think that to put a soundtrack on a book would take a lot away from, you know, the personal experience someone gets from reading a certain novel. Because, like, I don't really think that any two people read the same novel the same exact way, you know?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think that a lot of, a lot of the great parts about reading a book is that you're reading an author's words, you know, but you're kind of, like, relating it with your own personal experiences. And it's not, like, the same as just being fed a movie from, you know, like being fed all the visuals, being fed all the dialogue, being fed all the music. You know, you can kind of insert your own personal emotions into any book that you read. And I think
Michael,
it
you said
take
it,
a lot away from it.
You said it better than I. That's what I was trying to say, but you articulated it better. Thank you. It was the best of times. It was the worst times. When you say it was the worst times, they hit you over the head with a hammer. I mean, like, it's so ridiculous, the whole concept. And maybe in 10 years, we're going to be looking back and saying, this is what reading
hit you
is.
Over the head with a hammer.
Well, I mean, isn't that essentially what this vest, this technological vest that you're supposed to strap
our
on?
Our emailers are going in another direction.
Can I tell you
I don't
something
think
also,
I can read them on the air.
How great is it to be lying in bed reading a book, which is where it's the most fun? And as you say, you have this thing strapped all over your body that you had to, like, buckle yourself into before. Boy, that's a really
the
relaxing
soundtrack,
experience.
Though, remember that famous theme from Gone with the Wind? You could be reading along and have the orchestra in the background.
But as I said to Pedro, go see the movie. That's what a movie is. It has a soundtrack. Do you remember about 20 years ago, maybe, I don't know, 25 years ago, there was an experiment. This is true. And if you didn't know it, you're going to say I made it up, but I didn't. Do you know what smell-o-vision was?
I read about it in this piece.
In the theater. I actually went to a smell-o-vision movie.
What were you
it's
smelling?
It's true. Well, whatever it helped, whatever the thing was, I have no recollection
you
what the
want
movie
good
was.
Smells.
There were odors in that came, maybe it was a movie where the protagonist was a great cook. I have no recollection. It was so phony. And so, it was just ridiculous. It was even the. I mean, that's a
you
film
smell the
too.
Burnt rubber as the hero whatever, tried to make his escape.
Whatever it was, I mean, the book should be. A book is a book. I know that is a deep thought.
Where did you go to smell-o-vision?
Where
in Boston?
I went to the smell-o-vision cinema. I believe it was. There was a whole new line of smell-o-vision theaters in Philadelphia. Where I have no idea where I went.
Okay.
Let's go to Sheila Nord.
Hi, Sheila.
Sheila, you into this or what? You're a writer. She's written children's books.
Yes,
how about
she
this?
Has.
How about having a crying baby in the background, Sheila?
Oh, lovely. I was thinking it's sort of an advanced version of Scratch and Sniff, so I know what you're saying about smell-o-vision.
That's what it was, essentially.
Yeah, and I actually think what they're not taking into account is that you may actually be in bed with someone else. So that the other person is sort of, I thought putting on a light was bad enough for another person. But if you're reading like Old Man and the Sea and you start wetting the bed, that should be lovely. So I think as you said, Jim, I think we already have this with movies.
That's
so
what it is.
Get the idea behind it.
But, so, you know, the frightening part, I have to say, Sheila, and I think your call was perfect. Thanks so much for giving us a buzz.
What's the name of the book? What's the name of the book? We'll give a plug to our book.
What's the name of the book, Sheila?
Willoughby's. Oh, yes. That you can read in bed without wetting the bed.
What is it called?
Willow's Walkabout. It's a children's guide to Boston, and it's a wonderful little story. It takes place over Patriots Day.
It's fabulous.
It's a lovely way to think of Patriots Day.
We both love it. Marjorie and I both love it. Sheila, thanks. Nice to speak to you. It's a great kid. It's a really fun, great kids book. The writing and the illustration.
Teresa just emailed. She said, imagine doing Into Thin Air, the oxygen deprivation you'd have to feel. I don't think I want to feel that either.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I actually...
Or cold, if you read
did
one
did you read
the,
Into Thin Air, by the way? That's a perfect
and
example.
And you're freezing.
Yeah.
Freezing.
And you say to yourself...
frostbitten.
As the caller said, I can't remember the guy's name from a couple of minutes ago, you want to imagine the experience. You don't want to experience the experience.
Nancy Keene's coming up next
couple
year.
Couple of minutes.
Keene wrote the book about Shackleton. Out there in the Antarctica.
She'd be stuck in the ice, right?
Stuck in the ice for 2 years.
Right.
Like that poor guy that survived for 13 months in
that.
The fishing boat.
So you're reading your Shackleton book. You have to have your feet dipped in buckets with ice. It's the only way you can experience what Shackleton and his men did. Let's take one more and see what we're doing here. Jim, you're in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey there, Jim.
Hi, it's Jim. How are you?
Oh, sorry.
Hi.
That's okay. First time caller here.
Well, thank you.
And I'm kind of preaching to the choir, it seems, at this point. Because I agree that I don't think we should have sensory input from somebody else's perspective. However, on the other hand, it just so happens I'm in the middle of a giant Beatle biography.
Yeah.
That brings us way back to when the Beatles were kids. And, you know, they talk about the first song John Lennon wrote. So I said, let me for the hell of it Google it so I could hear this song without having the contraption that we're speaking of here, because we already have a contraption that can do the same thing.
Well,
so
yes,
I go on YouTube and I can listen to a song that performs on a very primitive recording, but I can get the information I need to get from the book.
So where does that, I don't know where you end up, Tim, do you end up saying that maybe in limited circumstances it would make sense
if
it's integrated?
Well, it seems to me you guys were talking about two things. One of them was a sensory thing, and the other one was like a soundtrack.
Soundtrack, yeah, that was the, right, that was the first thing, yeah,
so
the immersive reading.
A soundtrack where you can be the person who picks and chooses what you want to search.
Hey, which biography are you reading, by the way?
I think the author's name is Mark Lewisham, and it's called All These Years, and it's a three-part. I'm only reading the first one, and that has 800 pages in it. So they really really pick it apart. It's really interesting.
Well, it's the 50th anniversary, as we all know. Now, thank you, Tim, for the call. We appreciate it.
Mark and Robert emailed to say you're spreading tales. It was not Smell-O-Vision. It was Odorama. Waters film Polyester?
No, it wasn't Polyester. I would have remembered
Polyester.
Included a scratch
and sniff card to be used according to prompts in the film?
Well, actually, they're right, I think. It was a scratch thing. I was wrong about that. It wasn't sent in through the ventilation system. But it wasn't I've seen Polyester. It wasn't Polyester.
Know if it was Smell-O-Vision or Odorama.
Whatever it was, there were odors. Who cares what it was? Odor-Vision or Smell-O-Rama, whatever it was ridiculous. I mean, it doesn't matter what...
It was Odorama. Or Smell-O-Vision.
Right, exactly. I just said that. I just don't know what it is. But
okay.
Moving on.
Coming up, we're going to look at how retirement is changing. From those who can't afford to call it quits to those who just don't want to retire. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Our job as good investigative reporters is working as watchdog reporters.
Jennifer McKim, senior investigative reporter.
I wrote a story about lead in candies where we showed that children were being poisoned by candy, and this was shocking to the community that this was happening under our watch.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now a partner with WGBH News.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Skinner, presenting American Indian and Tribal Art at Auction, Wednesday, February 12th at Skinner's Marlboro Gallery, featuring Southwestern pottery, basketry, textiles, and turquoise jewelry. You can learn more at SkinnerInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Retirement is not what it used to be. The idea of hanging it up at the age, 55, hitting the golf course seems absurd. Today, most people can't afford to retire, and those who can afford to want to retire from retirement. We'll explain that in a couple of minutes. Joining us for her take on how aging in the workforce is changing is Nancy Kane. Nancy, as you know, is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there, Nancy.
Hey there.
Well, I read this morning that Americans aren't saving enough, that we're supposed to be saving 11 times our final working salary to retire at 65. Wow, I think that's not happening for a lot of us, Nancy Kane.
it certainly isn't. The average American who's 50 years old has $46,000 in retirement. Right now, he or she has a very good chance of living, if it's a woman, into her early 80s, if it's a man, into his late 70s. Right, somewhere between 15 and 20 of those years, there will be real medical issues. Right. And the certainty of insurance paying for all that is, shall we say, very low. So the big landscape picture is that most Americans don't believe and indeed don't have nearly enough in their, whatever their age, in their savings accounts to retire, at their current lifestyles or even at something approaching their current lifestyles.
But the sense I get, I sort of hinted at that when we were introducing you a minute ago, is those who might want to retire can't afford to. I know this is a bold and probably overly grand statement, but you can tell me how you feel about it. Those who want to retire probably can't afford to retire. And those who can afford to retire, for the most part, don't want to retire. They want to keep working. That's not far off, is it?
That's not far off. So we know that the former is about the arithmetic, right? The savings and, kind of forestalled consumption, right? deferred consumption of American savings habits. And remember, P.S., that most boomers, who are the folks now on the edge of retiring, those are people born between roughly 1946 and 1964, have kids in college, aging parents themselves who may have medical bills that they're helping pay, you know, rising health care costs and housing costs and other kinds of...
And they're going to live longer.
And they're going to live longer. So this is all kind of... It always reminds me of kind of, you know, you're going to feed the, like, elephant to the snake. It's like this big societal problem that's coming through the chute, right? And the chute is way too small or in some sense unprepared to deal with it. So I think the first problem or the first issue that you're raising, Jim, is partly a behavioral and macroeconomic personal finance issue, and it's a big deal, you know, capital B, capital D. The second issue is about the changing nature of work and our relationship with it, right? So there's a very interesting New York Times article published, for, you know, 6 months ago about different people who are turning their hobbies and their kind of passions into money-making retirement pursuits, from the seamstress who, you know, starts creating a business out of porch sewing industrial strength porch screens for people to use, you know, through three seasons, to, you know, the hairstylist Michael Casey, who's mentioned in the New York Times article, who, you know, loves doing hair and has a loyal client base and no
room
on his...
He's young 60s,
yeah. He's a young 60s, and, you know, and people who love their work or wanted to do something all their life that wasn't what they got their W-2 for and now have a chance to try something new and in a changing working environment, a changing economy, you know, figure out how to piece together something often, more often than not, entrepreneurial to do that. So that's about, it's about two things. It's about the changing nature of work and our relationship with it. It's also about the need. And there's an enormous satisfaction with this need. So it's more than a policy, you know, exclamation point for people to start taking more, deeper and better and more serious control over their own gifts and skills and experiences and their careers as the economy and their life, you know, changes and evolves. And that's important for everybody. And it's particularly manifest in people that are saying, no, I don't want to retire. I want to do this or I want to do that. And that's just fascinating. Hopeful and fascinating.
I want to ask you about the piece where you mentioned it's a reflection, you said, of people's changing relationship to their work. You describe the scenario, which I find very appealing, is somebody is at the end of their normal work career, and they say, God, I really love doing X, which
and
is
I don't love golf,
which
right?
is different from what I've done in the past. Uh-huh. So I'm going to do it. Forget them for a minute. How about people who are not all of a sudden glomming onto something wonderful that they can do as sort of a second career, but as some people whose relationship to work is such that that's who they are, is they can't be a retired person. They have to be a working person because that's how they see themselves as being of value.
And that's how they're wired sometimes,
yeah,
right? At
that's
a very fundamental
too, yeah.
level. So
yeah.
I just finished teaching a class literally half an hour ago about Alexander Hamilton and Josiah Wedgwood in this history of leadership class.
Oh, do
so
tell.
Wedgwood is the creator of the Wedgwood Pottery Company, comes of age at another moment of great economic change as Britain is industrializing, creates the first consumer brand, creates this astounding brand loyalty around China, right? And first celebrity sanction. He sells this cream-colored china to King George's wife, Queen Charlotte, calls it queensware. So all the beginning to be what's beginning to be the middle class will ape their betters in very Ralph Lauren-like way and have like a taste of the aristocratic life, not unlike Air Jordans. And then Alexander Hamilton, in some ways, his contemporary with a bigger vision about what the American economy could be. And several of my students in both sections at Harvard, these are both Kennedy School and Business School students, and a few undergraduates, commented on how these men are in love with their work. It's who they are. They don't slow down. They don't obviously they don't have iPhone applications to distract them, but there's lots of distractions. They just say no to it because they love to work. And you know, Karl Marx is going to go on and write about this, right, 100 years after 80 years after these men in Das Kapital and some of his other writings that are about the essence of work and its relation to our sense of satisfaction and creativity and our product being a reflection of who we are, whatever we make, whatever we do, whatever service we perform. And, you know, there's a lot of philosophy and a lot of interesting psychological evidence that for a great many people, work can be a source not only of identity, you know, perhaps less intently, a form of great and abiding satisfaction. So if you have any, if that means anything to you, retiring, right, with this big open slate you know, can be something that's not only daunting but somewhat unattractive.
Okay,
because
so
it takes you away from this aspect of your life that's very important to who you are and what you love.
Okay, let's go to the first half of the equation. Okay. Not the one who chooses to continue working, not for financial reasons, but reasons of satisfaction, identification. What's going to happen? And I've never seen anybody write convincingly about this. What is going to happen when the baby boomers who can't work anymore for whatever reason, either because the job's not there or because, well, they're not hireable, whatever it is, what happens?
And there are many of those probably in the unemployed workforce right now.
Exactly. Long-term unemployed and beyond. When those people come of age, and it's a huge part of the population, 50% of all the consumer spending is done by baby boomers in this society, which is colossal. What's going to happen to all those people? I mean, Barack Obama, we were talking to John King from CNN earlier about my RAs, and, you know, this notion that allegedly, you know, it's going to save those low and moderate income workers. What's going to happen to these people when the well runs dry and your average Social Security check gets you $14,000
a year? Right, exactly.
So what's going to happen? I mean, where are they going to be? What's going to happen to them? What's going to happen in society? I mean, really?
Oh, don't you think this is one of about five or six ticking time bombs?
No,
right?
But it is, isn't it?
It's huge.
Huge. Yeah.
It's huge. It's on the order of what's going to happen to our global water supply.
Well, I think it is, and it seems like you're serious about this.
I'm very serious. So I wouldn't mention global water if I didn't think it was pretty serious. And by the way, P.S., that's another can we're all kicking down the road,
that's
isn't it?
That's for another day.
That's for another day. Let's get a
but
little
bit more
trouble
than
that. Hold on. We just have to get, will we be dead before the global water supply is gone, or is it going to be happening soon? This is why I asked about global warming. Well, will the Cape be underwater in 20 years or 100 years?
Well, I think both of these big issues facing not just America, because the aging of the population and the end of defined benefits and the end of, you know, the funds of public monies that could provide government pensions, right, is not a line. It's asymptotic. It's a curve. So it's going to come faster and faster and faster until, what, the snake explodes, right, with the elephant? I don't know, Jim. But I know that if you look at the small data points that are averages that say a lot about large groups of people, we have a big, big problem. And the United States is not the only government that has, society that has this issue. A lot of the social welfare state in Europe faces
exactly
the same thing, right? Where people actually retire earlier often, right, with bigger hopes and promises. Think about Detroit and pension obligations to give you a small slice of this issue. Right? And those are people that were promised money. What about all the other people who weren't promised money?
I know I'm hyperbolic, and Marjorie knows this better than anybody, but I will say the following. One of the great immoralities of our time are those people who either work their whole lives based upon a contractual promise that they would get X dollars, even if it was more than they should have, even if they're from the public sector, as Marjorie will often say. And then all of a sudden, either close to retirement or during retirement, even worse, they're told that because of whatever the reason,
Polaroid.
The reason doesn't matter.
Polaroid.
Right, we're going to take your money away.
Sorry.
It is, to me, it is just an atrocity of epic proportions. And there's usually some screaming shortly after it happens. And then it fades into the background. These people are left to live in their agony.
The thing I learned during the whole Polaroid thing.
What happened is
the company went under, and people that had all these expectations for their pensions were left practically high and dry. The government did come in with that big, we'll bail you out on your pension thing.
But it was a small piece
But it only goes up to $40,000, correct?
But
I believe we're running out of that possibility too, because if more and more companies go under and leave their pensioners high and dry, the government's not going to be backing up all these companies either.
There was a story, and I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, but close enough that you don't have to email and correct me. There was a story on the front page of the Globe after this Polaroid thing wound down or whatever, that talked about a woman who decided, or a man, a person who decided to work their whole career at Polaroid, even though they didn't like it that much there, but decided to stay an extra for one reason
benefits.
And one reason only, the pension benefits. Yeah. And then the trigger for the story was the check she received after the litigation, which was something like $9 or some incredible thing. But let's step back from that outrage for a minute. For people who are not being, excuse the expression, screwed, like we just described, but just people living their lives, working their lives, can't get a job, the numbers are going to explode. And is anybody is seriously thinking about this, or is the notion that the next generation of leaders will have to deal with it so we don't have to?
Well, I think there's some of that going on. It's going on with the environment. It's going on with the financial system. It's going on with this, you know, the aging of the population, of which this is a central, if not the most important, policy and macroeconomic and social stability issue. I think lots and lots of people are thinking about it. Lots and lots of people. And the gentle or perhaps meek, you know, pragmatically meek salvo that the Obama administration fired over the bow at the State of the Union about my IRA, it is hard to say, right, is you know, is some kind of – represents some kind of evidence that that indeed is happening. It's not enough. It's not a big deal, but it's it starts a conversation that's been started and stopped many, many times. You know, so remember there – again, from historian's cap on. So it's a confluence of circumstances, or to use 18th century language, as I've been living in the 18th century the last few days, a concatenation of circumstances. The end of the social contract as it grew up in the 20th century. That's the end of pension, corporate provided, defined benefit, pensions, right? The end of government largesse and underpinning, a kind of safety or floor for those pensions because governments, the cupboard is dry, right, as the child's nursery rhyme says. And yet at the same time, generations of people that have grown up, at least two, maybe three generations of people that have grown up with that expectation. And to your point, contractually, you know, contractually upheld, legally, written-wise upheld, and then overturned. So I think from, a large picture perspective, some of people's sense of disenfranchisement, we were talking about income inequality last week, sense of being the haves and the have-nots, sense of possibility, sense of personal empowerment, and P.S., sense of personal rage, we wonder about the rage in different pockets of our country, is about some of this, if you will, charcoal, flaming fire of circumstances that we see very, very clearly when we talk about how America and other countries are set up to live as long as people will live and to live decently and to fuel an economy and to keep order and to act as guardians for the next generation and to be neighbors and to be pillars of wisdom and experience, which older generations have traditionally been.
What's that 18th century word again? I want to use it.
Concatenation of circumstances.
Concatenation.
Oh my gosh.
That means a coming together of circumstances.
Yeah, a coming together of things
Love
you
that.
Wouldn't have thought that Love would come that. Together. All those things are happening at once. So we got a big deal here. But again, let's go back to the personal, because the personal is always more meaningful than the numbers. And we can see the sum of the personal in the numbers, right? Average Social Security check, $1,298 a month, folks. So again, I wish for leaders that would, as Lincoln did in the Gettysburg Address, right? He told us what the battle was about. Then he gave us a reason to do something about the importance of the issues at stake on that battlefield. I wish that leaders, whether they're community leaders or pastors or rabbis or government leaders or, you know, our president or his opponents would say, look, you have the means, you have the American ingenuity, you have the history, you still have, despite all its problems, the economy and possibility of taking charge of parts of your life in terms of preparing yourself for this moment. You know, American consumers are very good at taking charge of them, of their spending money. Look at what happens now, post-financial crisis, to any kind of shock to the system. Unemployment numbers. Consumer spending goes way down. I don't know if you saw the article in the New York Times yesterday about consumers are now, because of the Target and Neiman Marcus and other credit card, you know, hacking scandals, are now actually going to spending more in cash.
Really?
And spending less as a result because they're worried about their credit cards. American consumers are incredibly reactive and adaptive. So why can't we trust the American people and empower them and inspire them to do the same kind of adaptation with their own careers? It won't solve all the problems, but it will help people get the kind of, in some sense, training or look for companies like this interesting article that some of your folks found, Chelsea Mertz, our producer, found, about Vita Needle, this very interesting company in Massachusetts where the entrepreneur figured out, I'm going to hire all these folks in their 8th or 9th decade or 10th decade, and they're going to be great workers. I'm not going to pay them a huge amount necessarily, but I'm going to give them a decent job, lots of respect and make them at the center of my company. And P.S., they don't steal. They show up for work. They're incredibly loyal. They know a lot. And my company is very productive. So how can we empower people to find roadways up and out of that what looks like a policy and social morass and get some more control and sense of satisfaction out of what they can become in an economy that has always been about individuals making themselves up as they go along?
That's the voice of Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. You know, Nancy, this is not totally on, but did you watch the Super Bowl?
No.
Okay.
I got tenure 10 years ago. I could stop watching the Super Bowl then.
Okay. What was said by the announcers about 400 times is the incredibly youthful-looking coach of the Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll, is either the oldest or the second oldest or the something coach ever win a Super Bowl. He's 62 years old. He looks like he's 42 years old. With a level of energy that is I know this is not directly related to this, but as I'm watching I'm saying, is that going to change? Is watching him for 3 hours, 111 million people watching him, hearing him referred to, and he really does. You watched part of the game, right?
I did not.
You didn't watch any
of it? She has tenure, too.
No, I didn't either.
Oh, I thought you did.
I went to the movies.
She made it up.
And there were no lines.
She told me she did the other day.
And there were no lines at the movie.
Does that have an impact on how people view themselves and their potential vis-a-vis their relationship to work?
Of course it does. Of course it does. So remember, you know.
So wasn't that ridiculous a point, was it?
Not at all. It's a really important point. It's back to what we each can do step by step, brick by brick. What Taz did say, Rome wasn't built in a day, brick by brick. Our lives are lived brick by brick. Brick by brick. Look at him and then say, wow, isn't he zippy? Isn't it great that someone in his seventh decade is doing something so energizing, inspiring, and for many people, so important, including, by the way, building a great team, right, that kind of blew Denver out of the water. I do know it was the Broncos.
Very impressive.
And there's something else here. You know, Lincoln once said, I think people are about as happy as they make their mind up to be. So our spirit, we can't necessarily control what's going to happen to Social Security. We can't necessarily control what's going to happen to bankruptcy proceedings that eat away, I would argue, wrongly at people's promised pensions. But we can control how we respond to some of those things, often in very different circumstances. So I think what he represents, it's the same thing Estee Lauder represented, because she was, you know, putting cream on women's faces and selling her perfume well into her 90s, is an indomitable and energetic spirit. I've met 35-year-old men and women that were 70. 36 going on 70. And I've met people in their 60s that were going on 28, right? And still had youthful, childlike, you know, joy and wonder.
What did Michael Dukakis say to us a couple of weeks ago in studio?
80 is the new 20.
80 is
and
the
then
new
there's
20.
This. Yeah. Then there's this. As we all get older, we all want to kind of feel like we're younger. So, you know, think about the cougar as a phenomenon, right? Young women dating older, young men dating older women and older mandating, well, that's not so uncommon, but that's all about new definitions, not only of work and our relationship with it and possibility over a lifetime, but different phases and different and evolving conception of what our youth and vitality mean. And that is absolutely critical, not just to how we feel, not just to social order. It's critical to how productive and prosperous our economy is. So yes, our coach, that coach matters.
Well, you do see one thing about the baby boomers. A lot of baby boomers do not want to get old. So there's a lot of, you know, of exercising and eating right.
Anti-wrinkle creams, right?
Anti-wrinkle creams. I'm there with the anti-wrinkle creams, let me tell you. And when you think of your parents, you know, when they were 40 or 50, they looked a lot older than a lot of people do today that are 40 and 50.
You know why that was, Marjorie?
Why?
Because they did not bring those little Tupperware cups to work like I do every day that you ridicule me
but
little droplets of different kinds of food.
But you know what a big thing was? A lot of them were big-time smokers.
That's a very good point.
Right, and we know more about health, and consumers are much better educated. But in the end, there's still an enormous, you know, we were just talking about Hamilton and Wedgwood, but particularly Hamilton believed greatly in the energy, person by person, of an economy being a source of great innovation, therefore great prosperity, therefore more social cohesion. So the energy and the spirit, no matter what our age, right, that we bring to the table every day with our family and our work and our public life, whether we're, you know, whatever we're doing or, you know, or at a given moment, that energy is actually an enormously important part of a collective people's sense of possibility.
So we only have a few seconds left here, like 10 seconds left. But can we do things for retirement? I mean, it's not hopeless, I hope.
Oh, and you have 3 seconds to answer the question.
Well, there are possibilities that we can do things, the government and people together. So
oh, absolutely. And there's some of the most interesting innovations, if you will, in financial instruments, right, at both the corporate level and the individual level, are all about different ways of helping people learn to save better. So, yes, we are dealing with this.
Well, we should revisit
whether the elephant
this,
will explode or not is a really open question.
That image is
really
troubling.
I'm not saving any better.
Nice to see you, Nancy.
Pleasure. thank you, Nancy Kane, historian at Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, the Secretary of Education, Matt Malone, is taking our questions and yours, and medical ethicist Art Kaplan take his take on the heroin epidemic. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, Amanda McGowan, and I am Marjorie Egan.
Yes, you are, and I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening. Hope you tune in tomorrow.
See ya.